The challenge to get pricing right can sometimes feel a bit intimidating. How do you make the right decision? Austrian Economics eliminates the tension by treating pricing as a process rather than a one-time decision. Peter Klein explains.
This is the Economics for Entrepreneurs podcast, a project of the Mises Institute, applying the principles of economics to start, grow, and manage your business. For free tools, resources, key takeaways, and actionable insights from each episode, visit Mises.org/E4EPod. Now, here's Hunter Hastings.
Hi, Hunter Hastings here. Today we are discussing pricing. What a critical topic for business, and what a difficult element to get just right. Happily, Austrian Economics extracts the angst from pricing decisions and pricing management because we view pricing as a process rather than a single data point that you have to get right. And we see pricing in a way that is uniquely insightful. Austrian Insights suggests the method for managing pricing and top-line revenue flows. First, we know who sets the price. That's the consumer for final consumption goods. And the Austrian principle is that the consumer sets the price for all the intermediate goods and services in the production chain, because they're all determined by their contribution to the final consumer price. All intermediate prices are set by supply and demand and the ultimate service of the final consumer and the price they are willing to pay. Willingness to pay means they won't refrain from buying. The consumer's willingness to pay is based on subjective value, the dollars they're willing to exchange for an experience they believe is worth more than holding on to the dollars they expend, or more than an alternative use of those dollars. Subjective value varies a lot, contextually, situationally, with location, with time, and with how the consumer is feeling amidst all these variables. Consider 12 ounces of Coca-Cola. In the supermarket on a Thursday morning, a shopper might be willing to pay 45 cents for it in a bottle that comes in an 8-pack at room temperature, or 42 cents if it comes in a can and a 6-pack at room temperature, or $2 if it comes out of a refrigerated vending machine in a hotel vending room on a warm night in Auburn, Alabama, or $4 if it comes as part of a big fountain beverage serving at a football game. So what is the consumer willing to pay for 12 ounces of Coca-Cola? It depends. What's the value of 12 ounces of Coca-Cola? It depends. What's the price of 12 ounces of Coca-Cola? It depends. When the consumer is evaluating the purchase, he or she might use price per ounce as their value benchmark, comparing the price of 1 ounce in a 6-pack and 1 ounce delivered in a 24-pack, and finding that the price per ounce is lower for the larger size package, choose to buy 24 cans. She spends more dollars, but her cost per ounce realization feels like more value. How does the Coca-Cola company know all this? How does it get pricing right? Austrians call it a process of discovery. We'll ask Peter Klein in a second how that might work, and how it might work to an entrepreneur's advantage. There are several major implications of price discovery for business. The first is attitudinal. Don't worry about price or fret about trying to raise prices. Find a starting point and then proceed in two directions. One is to calculate and manage your costs so that the price you have discovered yields a profit, and specifically an improving profit because you're always working to reduce costs. Another is to find those contexts and situations and moments where the consumer willingness to pay is higher. We'll try to find a couple of examples in our conversation. This all suggests that pricing, like all of economics, is a process. We'll try to give you some pointers to visualize how the process unfolds and how you can act to find new knowledge at various points that will help you in your goals for cash flow and profit. You're familiar with Peter Klein on Economics for Entrepreneurs podcast by now. Peter is professor of entrepreneurship at Baylor University's Hankamer School of Business. He's also senior research fellow at Baylor's Bohr Center for Entrepreneurship and Free Enterprise. He is expert in the field of transaction costs and organization, and his book titled Organizing Entrepreneurial Judgment is definitive. Peter, hello.
Hi, Hunter. How are you today?
I'm terrific. Thanks for joining us again on Economics for Entrepreneurs.
No, it's my pleasure to be with you as always.
We're talking about pricing today, and we're talking about pricing for entrepreneurs and pricing for products and services. It's a critical area of management. It's fundamental, obviously, to generating revenues, to cash flows, and to making transactions at all. You've got to find the price for a transaction. It can be quite intimidating. It's certainly a place where there's lots of uncertainty. But I've promised our listeners in the preamble that thinking like an Austrian can take away a lot of tension. So that's our goal today.
So, I agree with that.
Good. Let's see if we can do that. Let's start by defining what a price is, Peter. Let's start with a definition. What is a price?
Sure. Well, before I answer the question, I would just remark, you're so right about how fundamental pricing is to our thinking about markets and economic interactions and profits and so forth. In fact, an older term for economics that many of the Austrians used was the term price theory. So economics is really a theory about prices because prices are so fundamental to sort of understanding what we do in a market and market activity is typically manifest in prices. It's a really fundamental concept for all of us. So simple definition of a price is, you can think of a price as the rate at which we exchange one thing for another, right? So even in an economy without a monetary system, an old-fashioned barter economy, you know, Robinson Crusoe and his island engaging in exchange with Friday, you know, if Robinson Crusoe catches fish and Friday is collecting coconuts that have fallen to the ground and they agree that they will exchange, you know, one fish for two coconuts, well, we can think of that as a price, right? We could say the price of a fish is two coconuts or the price of a coconut is one half of a fish. It the price simply describes the rate at which we exchange one kind of a thing for another. And because economics is fundamentally about exchange, people exchanging goods and services for other goods and services, including money as one of the goods or services that you can trade things for, pricing really sets sort of the terms within which we interact and you know, make ourselves better off through commercial activity.
So there's a couple of things to unpack there, Peter, I think. One is that that price occurs for a single transaction, and it doesn't necessarily mean that the next time coconuts are exchanged for fish or for money, that the price is the same. Is that correct? It's a one-time transaction.
That's exactly right. I mean, I stopped in Starbucks this morning on my way into work, and I purchased a coffee for, you know, say it's $3 or whatever. I mean, I gave up $3 out of my pocket, or in my case, electronically out of an app, right, in exchange for a cup of hot coffee with things in it. So I gave up $3 in exchange for the coffee. I got something I valued more than the $3 I gave away. And for Starbucks, it's the reverse, right? They obtained $3, which was more valuable to Starbucks than the value of the cup of coffee that was exchanged. So we each got something we valued more in exchange for something we valued less, and that $3 was sort of the terms of trade. Now, it so happens for many commercial transactions between individual consumers and large sellers, you know, there's not a lot of negotiation that goes on. I mean, Starbucks posted a price of $3 on the, you know, it's on the sign, it's on the app, it's on the menu, whatever. And I simply gave up my $3 in exchange for the coffee. And the person who was in line behind me, if she purchased the same drink, she would also pay the same price. But that isn't necessarily so, right? As anybody knows who's bought a house, or if you're engaged in, if you're an entrepreneur who buys large quantities of inputs or you sell outputs to other people, obviously every price can be negotiated. A price, as you said, Hunter, is attached to every individual transaction. And, you know, to what extent we choose to negotiate each, the price of every transaction, on the spot, or to what extent we decide to just state a price and say, look, I'm not going to negotiate, it's a take it or leave it offer. You know, that's up to the market participants to decide, is it worth the hassle of negotiating and sort of setting a price for every transaction, or do we want to just kind of write it down and let people trade or not at that posted price? That's something that market participants decide based on their subjective valuations, how much they want to negotiate, the value of their time, and so forth.
So if you went to Starbucks this afternoon and they were charging $3.25 for a cup of coffee, and let's say you chose to buy that, you're still willing to pay $3.25. So is the price of coffee now $3.25 at Starbucks?
Yeah, it's a great question, because the language of prices and pricing is often used in a kind of inconsistent and imprecise way, especially by financial analysts and commentators and government officials and so forth, right? What is the price of coffee? And you might hear, you might read an article in the Wall Street Journal that says, well, coffee prices have been rising over the last, 3 months. What does that mean? I mean, that doesn't necessarily mean that Peter paid a higher price for his coffee on one particular day as opposed to another particular day, right? So there's one sense, look, as we've just defined it, the price is the exchange ratio that governs a particular transaction in a particular place at a particular time. But we also use the language of pricing in a different way, right? What economists call an equilibrium price, or what analysts might call sort of a long-term price. Here's a good way to understand it, I think, is let's say that Starbucks charges $3.25 for the coffee. And maybe I walk in and I say, $3.25 is a lot to pay for a cup of coffee. When I was a kid, Hunter, when you were a kid, people did not pay those kinds of prices for ordinary coffee. I might say, I'm just not going to do it today. I'm going to start brewing my coffee at home, or getting my coffee at the gas station, or whatever. Now, it's still the case on that day that I chose not to pay $3.25. I mean, Starbucks still has a menu in their store where somebody has written $3.25. And that's the posted price that they are, offering. They're stating, look, that's the terms at which we're willing to trade. You give us $3.25, we give you a coffee. Let's say that's true for the rest of that day. Maybe it's true for the rest of that week or the rest of that month. However, suppose that there are lots of people like Peter Klein who say, that's too much. And Starbucks finds that at a posted price of $3.25, they get fewer customers than what they had anticipated. They raise less revenue than what they were hoping to raise or what they would like to raise. They may say, we're going to lower the posted price back down to $3, right? We're going to say, well, maybe $3.25 was not a sustainable price in the long term. It was not a sort of a long-term equilibrium price. The market will not support a price of $3.25. We're going to have to lower that price to $3, right? So it's still the case that anybody who bought at $3.25, and probably a few people did, right? I mean, $3.25 was the price of every transaction. That just wasn't a kind of sustainable price that lots of customers are willing to accept in the long term. Another way you could describe it is there are sticker prices, mm-hmm. right? There's the price that is written on the sign or on the sticker, and there are actual prices that people pay. I might be a cafe owner, and I might say, Peter's coffee is so good, it's $10 a cup. And I write $10 on my sign, or I put $10 on a little sticker on every coffee cup, and not a single person buys. You say, well, what's the price of Peter's coffee? Well, I had a posted price or a sticker price of $10. The actual you know, exchange ratio for all transactions that took place doesn't even exist because no transactions took place. So there really wasn't an actual price that was relevant in the market that day. Yet I had an asking price of $10. Or you might list your house for $1 million and you don't get any buyers. What's the price of your house? Well, my house never sold. So there really isn't a price because nobody ever bought it. Oh, but if I look you up on Zillow, I see that the price is $1 million. Mm-hmm. Again, that's like an asking price. Or some people, some economists call that a reservation price.
Yeah.
For the seller, what's the lowest price I'm willing to accept? For the buyer, what's the highest price I'm willing to pay? But that may not be an actual price that occurs in the market because there wasn't a sale.
In some markets, they have manufacturer's recommended price, which is a purely speculative
kind. Absolutely.
Of a flag to put on something before you negotiate another price.
And you know, Hunter, I hate it when people say, oh, well, how do entrepreneurs make profits? Well, they just take their cost. They just mark it up by 15%. That's the price. That's how much money they make. Well, look, I can choose to put a sticker price on my product of 15% more than what I paid to make it. But that doesn't guarantee that anybody's going to pay that. That may not be the price that obtains on the market. That's just an amount of money I would like to receive for my product. It doesn't make it an actual price. You have to have buyers who are willing to pay that.
Peter is pointing out a lot of confusion about how entrepreneurs make a profit. We've recorded an online course that spells out exactly how entrepreneurs make a profit in our 12-step Austrian Entrepreneur's Journey. You can find it and you can buy it as an online course at e4epod.com/journey. That's the letter E, the number 4, the letter E, pod.com/journey. And now back to our conversation. Yeah, so let's drill down right there, Peter. The Austrian principle is that the customer or the consumer ultimately determines the price. So tell us about that, how that works in theory and how that works in real life. Do they really determine prices?
Sure. Yeah. Ludwig von Mises has this very vivid passage in Human Action where he describes the customer as the captain of the ship, you know, who is sort of forcing the ship to go in the direction that the customer or the market consumers want the ship to go. And the entrepreneur is just kind of like, you know, one of the sailors trying to keep the ship afloat. But it's really the customer who's at the consumers who are at the wheel or at the tiller. That strikes a lot of people as odd because many of us in our day-to-day affairs, you know, I bought something on Amazon. I went to the grocery store. I bought some supplies from Walmart. You know, they didn't ask me what I wanted to pay. Mm-hmm. They just said, this is how much you're paying. So it relates to this distinction that I was alluding to before. What the Austrians mean when they say consumers set the price is that, you know, consumers will only pay in the market prices that they are willing to pay. The seller is free to set a posted price or to determine a sticker price, whatever the seller wants. But consumers will never pay more for something than what they anticipate subjectively they are going to get in return, right? And so you can't compel anybody to buy your thing. So anybody who does buy at the sticker price is getting something that they value more than what they're giving up. That's the first point. But the second point is that in the long run, if you've set that sticker price too high, then you're going to have to lower that price if you want to stay in business, right? So in the long run, or even in the medium run, consumer valuations, which determine consumers' willingness to pay, those set constraints on the prices that are really feasible for entrepreneurs to set. So yeah, it's not the case that consumers literally moment by moment are dictating to the seller what price to write on the sign. That's not the argument. But in the long run, consumers will only buy what they are willing to buy. And if consumers really love something, then sellers can increase the price, the posted price, and still sell. If consumers don't love the thing, the seller is going to have to lower the posted price if he or she wants to be able to sell. So that is the sense in which consumers determine kind of these longer run equilibrium prices that take place. So it's a very reasonable, common sense kind of statement, even though it strikes many people as odd at first glance.
Yeah, so they determine prices in a long-term adjustment in a competitive market. I see that. And then that leads us, Peter, to a second Austrian principle, which I think can be very helpful to entrepreneurs, and that is that pricing is a discovery process, that the entrepreneur, as you said, can't be a price setter. They may be a price taker, although we can debate that, but you've got to discover the price that the buyer is willing to pay. So tell us about the discovery process, how that might work.
Yeah, I think that's a useful metaphor for understanding how it looks from the entrepreneur's point of view, right? So for the inputs that I purchase, right, and for the products that I sell to customers, you know, you can imagine a scenario where every transaction is negotiated individually. Right. And most of us have experienced that in a few cases, buying a house, buying a car, whatever, maybe selling stuff, you know, on eBay or whatever. In a case like that, right? I mean, before I go into negotiations, I need to have some idea of what's the most I'm willing to pay, what's the lowest price I'm willing to accept. And that may be determined by a host of factors, right? Is this a perishable good? If I don't sell it today, I can't sell it ever. Well, that's going to make me less strict on price than if it's a thing that I can hold on to and maybe sell tomorrow mm-hmm. if nobody's willing to pay what I want to get for it today. But I've got to be kind of flexible and make some adjustments on that score. So let's say I go in with some idea of what I would like prices to be. You know, at what point am I going to say, oh, well, in that case, I'm just going to go home, right? That I've got to set. I have to have some idea of that before I go into negotiations. What happens at the end of those negotiations? Well, I mean, anybody who's ever been in a negotiation can tell you, you don't know when you're going in exactly how it's kind of going to come out. It depends on the negotiating skill of the various partners, and you know, conditions may change throughout the day. And you know, if I get a price that is within my acceptable range, that's the price I pay. I go home. Okay, what about the entrepreneur putting sticker prices on my product? Right? Mm-hmm. I've got to have a listed price. What should that listed price be? Well, entrepreneurs use a variety of techniques to try to figure out what is a reasonable sticker price that I should charge in my initial rounds of making my things available to customers. How do I determine that? Well, I've got my own past experience. Maybe selling a related product, I could look out there and see what people who are already selling a comparable product are asking for it. I can pay a market research firm to do some surveys or to do some interviews with customers, put some focus groups together, try to come up with a reasonable price. But Hunter, at the end of the day, I've just got to put my price out there in the market and see what happens. Right. I put my stickers on the thing. I say, I want $2.50. Keep my fingers crossed and see what happens. Right. And if everybody loves my thing and I'm selling out every day of my, you know, I'm selling out within a few hours, that tells me, gee, maybe I set the price a little bit too low. I could have gone even higher. And then I experiment the next opportunity to increase the price. I charge a little bit more and see what happens. And as long as I can sell, I'm happy. If I'm not selling, I think, gee, the price may be too high.
Or in the digital age, I could put 50 prices out there and see which one gets the most customer response, right?
Absolutely. And maybe I can engage in what they call price discrimination, right? Maybe I can set different prices for different types of customers. I could have one price for my, you know, online customers. I could have another price for retail customers. I could have one price for people who want to buy in advance. I could have another price for people who walk in on the spot. There's all kinds of creative things I can do. But what economists mean when they use this metaphor of discovery, they mean, you know, the price that will ultimately sell as many of these products as I want, that will give me the highest level of profit that I think I can obtain. I just don't know ahead of time exactly what that is. The only way to figure it out is through trial and error, through some experimentation an adjustment. And eventually I settle upon, I learn, or I discover the price that actually earns me, you know, the level of profit that I'm going for.
Mm-hmm. We seem to talk a lot about products naturally, but a lot of our listeners who are entrepreneurs are selling services, and maybe they're selling B2B services, or maybe they are SaaS entrepreneurs, software as a service. How should they go about discovering the marketplace price when perhaps you're negotiating with one B2B customer at a time who's got some policies about cost per hour or something like that?
I mean, that's such a great question. I mean, of course, services are different. Services are unique. They're not commodities in many cases, where it may be hard to find an external market reference that allows me to kind of set my initial expectations going into the negotiations. And yeah, I mean, we in my previous example, you know, I'm selling coffee or I'm selling gadgets or whatever, I'm imagining a world where, you know, there's one of me and there's a lot of customers, and I see how many people are willing to buy at this price, how many people are willing to buy at that price. The process is kind of similar, but not exactly the same if it's, maybe it's multiple rounds of negotiation with a single partner, right? A single potential buyer, or maybe it's a single a seller if I'm the buyer, right? So then we still have a kind of a discovery process of sort of feeling each other out, but it may be multiple rounds of sequential bargaining, mm-hmm. you know, between the same two parties instead of with different people coming into the store every time. But it's still the kind of idea that you mentioned, you know, I don't know exactly how much this person is willing to pay. Maybe I set a price that I think is a little bit extreme to sort of see how the other party reacts. And then we go back and forth in some kind of a scenario. And, you know, look, it might be different if I have a prior relationship with that potential buyer or seller compared to if it's a stranger. And it may be that, look, in selling services, we may be negotiating not only the price, but also other terms of the exchange. You know, even in the coffee example, you know, you think, well, a coffee cup is just a standard thing, and the only thing that is being negotiated, or the only thing that the entrepreneur is trying to discover, is should it be $2, $3, $3.25, or whatever. But of course, even in that example, there are lots of different ways. You know, is it coffee that is produced on the spot, or is it a coffee cup that's made in advance? Is it a coffee that the buyer can order on their app and then pick up as they walk in? Or is it something that they order and you make on the spot? Is it coffee plus the right to sit in my shop mm-hmm. for several hours and drink it? Or is it, no, drink a cup of coffee and then I need you to go because I need that table available for somebody else? There's a whole package. The thing that the customer is buying is an experience. It's maybe it's a relationship. It's a whole bunch of stuff in addition to a thing and a price. And all of those things, all of the elements of that package have to be discovered. And of course, if you're selling software as a service, or you're selling a consulting project to a particular buyer, yeah, of course, you're negotiating over the price, but you're also negotiating over all of the other terms. And you have to discover kind of an equilibrium bundle of attributes, including price, but all the other attributes as well.
Right. Yeah, your friend, Professor Stephen Phelan, when we were talking about negotiations, said, try to establish the top end. You know, what's the best price you think you can get and all the services you're willing to provide for that. The bottom end when you walk away because the price is too low. And then negotiation is a matter of finding out where in between those two ends the seller and the buyer arrive.
Exactly right. And there are also kind of there's a particular context in which the negotiation takes place. The appropriate rules for engaging in this discovery process, the norms may be different in you know, from culture to culture, from marketplace to marketplace, in different industries and so forth. And obviously you want to be familiar with the appropriate practices. You don't want to engage in some kind of a negotiation tactic as part of this discovery process that the other party thinks is inappropriate and maybe that you know, turns off your potential buyer or seller where they don't want to participate anymore. And, you know, people who have anyone who's done business in different countries, you know, knows that sometimes common practices and standards and norms can vary widely from country to country. And obviously, you want to engage in the discovery process within those kind of acceptable boundaries.
Yeah. Now, sometimes our entrepreneurs, Peter, tell me, well, that's all very well, but if I go to Whole Foods, they're going to tell me it's got to be this price to be on my shelf. Or if I go to dollar stores, it's the price has to have something to do with the dollar. Or you know, the channel is setting the price that the channel is going to put in front of the consumer, and the entrepreneur has a little influence there because they want to be on the shelf. So how does Austrian theory work in that situation?
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm sympathetic to that concern because we all experience that as individuals, right? I mean, there's like, you know, there's the pressure that can be put on prices by, you know, the group or class of people to whom I belong. And then there's how much pressure can I as an individual put on a particular transaction. Look, if I'm selling my stuff to Whole Foods, I'm selling my stuff to Walmart, everybody knows they are notoriously tough bargainers. And probably I need that shelf space for my business to be successful more than Whole Foods or Walmart's needs my product on the shelf for their businesses to be viable. So there's kind of an asymmetry of bargaining power there, mm-hmm. right, with me as an individual. And probably, you know, it may be that they make me a kind of a take it or leave it offer. And unfortunately, I've got to decide, am I going to take it or am I going to leave it? I mean, yeah, nobody wants to be in that situation, right? I'd prefer to be in the situation where I can kind of be on a more equal footing with my trading partner. But look, that's the nature of life. That isn't always the case. Again, just as I, as a consumer, when I go to Walmart and buy a tube of toothpaste, I just am not in much of a, I'm not in a position as an individual buyer to put pressure on Walmart to lower the price of toothpaste. You know, doesn't that prove that Mises is wrong when he describes the consumers as the captain of the ship?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, no, it doesn't, because look, if all of us as consumers, if tens of us, hundreds of us, thousands of us say, hey, Walmart, we're not paying that price for toothpaste, Walmart is going to have to lower that price. I mean, Peter Klein as an individual is not in a position to make that happen, but a whole bunch of Peter Kleins acting together certainly are in a position to make that happen. And so, yeah, I mean, the world is not always the way I would like it to be. I wish I could tell Walmart what to do. But the fact that I can't, it's not, you know, it's not a violation of my freedom. It doesn't mean I'm sort of forced to accept the price that Walmart demands. And, you know, it feels like that sometimes. And look, if I've got to have toothpaste right at that moment and I'm in a small town and Walmart's the only merchant in town, yeah, it kind of feels like I'm kind of compelled. Likewise, if I'm an entrepreneur, I've got a product and I feel like, gosh, if I can't get this thing in Whole Foods, my business is gonna fail. I sort of feel like I'm at the mercy of Whole Foods. And I understand and I'm sympathetic to that kind of sympathetic. That psychological feeling. But if we look at it, you know, if we analyze it, no, it's really not the case that I'm forced to take the price that Whole Foods gives me, because I could choose not to, you know, not to do it. I could choose to go into another line of business.
Yeah, maybe I'm buying, that's the price I'm paying for buying shelf space at Whole Foods.
Absolutely. And Hunter, there's, by the way, an interesting point that relates, it's on my mind because I'm engaged in a research project that relates to this. There are cases where, you know, sort of smaller buyers or smaller sellers can actually organize themselves, you know, on a voluntary market basis into kind of like a bargaining co-op or some kind of a coalition to try to explicitly put more pressure on sellers. I mean, a good example is, you know, some of the sort of open source software mm-hmm. and peer-to-peer sharing platforms. I mean, you could look at the history of some open source projects and software as a way of, you know, computer users or software consumers saying, look, we don't like paying the prices that Microsoft is charging for its proprietary products. We don't like what, you know, some other, you know, we don't like what Oracle is charging for its proprietary software. Let's come up with our own free and open shareable equivalent that not only is useful to us, but actually puts downward pressure on the prices charged by Microsoft, Oracle, and so forth. So there's nothing in a free market that prevents smaller buyers or sellers from trying to get together and maybe in an organized way come up with an alternative product or try to bargain with a large firm to get a better deal.
Yeah, good point. So another aspect of transactions is promotions and discounts, Peter. So we've talked about setting a price or discovering a price, but then there's $2 off or offer closes at midnight or summer sale or those kinds of things. Should we think about that as pricing from the entrepreneur's point of view, or is it a different economic activity entirely? It's a different kind of incentive. How do you look at that?
No, I think that is a great example of the sort of richness and variety and even complexity of the pricing process, right? So just as, you know, a cup of coffee isn't a cup of coffee isn't a cup of coffee, because there's also how long did you have to wait in line to get it and how pleasant was the environment in which you purchased it and so forth. All of those things form a package. That's the consumer is purchasing that package in exchange for the price. Likewise, pricing can have a lot of variety and complexity to it, with things like discounts and special offers, coupons, promotions. So, as I said earlier in the talk, because I stop at Starbucks from time to time, I have the Starbucks app on my phone, and I get some kind of bonus points. There's a rewards program, right? I get points or stars every time I purchase something from Starbucks, and when I've accumulated a certain amount of those loyalty points, I can cash them in for a free drink or for a discount or whatever. That is a tactic, a very creative and clever tactic that lots of sellers use to try to encourage repeat purchases and loyalty on the part of customers, right? It's good for the merchant because it makes the customer more likely on the margin to choose your product rather than someone else's product. I mean, the airline industry, of course, is extremely skilled at using frequent flyer programs mm-hmm. to sort of get people, sort of lock people in, lock in loyal customers, which makes those customers less price sensitive than they otherwise would be, right? So the seller can actually choose a higher can succeed with a higher price when you have loyal customers or less price sensitive customers than you can with other customers. You know, offering discounts. Hunter, I don't know about you. You're a young man, but I am not too far from the days of getting those wonderful senior citizen discounts, you know, from certain kinds of sellers, and I plan to take advantage of those whenever I can.
Mine have arrived already.
You know, that's, again, a very clever and creative tactic by merchants who say, look, some senior citizens, retirees, maybe they're not working full-time or maybe they're not working at all. They have more time to shop around. They're likely to be more price sensitive. So I'm going to give them a special deal. I'm going to say going to the movies costs less for you than it costs for a busy working professional, because we know the busy working professional, if he or she wants to go to the movies, they're not going to compare the price of every movie theater in town. Here's the movie I want to see. Here's the time it's showing that works for me. I'm just going to pay whatever price is offered. Whereas a senior citizen may say, I could choose to go to the movies on a different day. So it's a clever way for the merchant to offer a different price, different prices to different types of consumers, is to offer discounts and rebates and so forth for consumers who are willing to meet certain conditions or who can demonstrate that they, you know, that they, in this case, are above a certain age. You know, maybe coupons allow merchants to give a better price to people who are willing to take the time to collect coupons and use them. People who are less price sensitive because they're busy, or maybe they're extremely wealthy, they just don't care. Why give them a discount? They'll pay the higher price. And the way they demonstrate that is by showing that they're not willing to take the time to go seek out, discounts and rebate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's pricing with a different objective than a single transaction. That's pricing with the objective of multiple purchases, or as you say, loyalty.
The seller wants to get the best deal out of every possible buyer, and of course, the buyer wants to get the best deal out of every possible seller. On the buyer side, we use comparison shopping and search engines and all kinds of things to try to get good prices. The seller wants to use information about potential buyers to get the best possible price out of every buyer. Hunter, a concept that maybe we should have mentioned before, but it's worth mentioning now, there's a technical term that economists use, and entrepreneurs may or may not use this particular terminology, but it's useful for thinking about, that this technical term that economists use is called elasticity. Economists refer to the elasticity of demand for a particular product. That's just a fancy way of saying how price sensitive are the buyers of this particular product. So we say, if we say the demand for my product is highly elastic, what that means is if I try to increase the price, a lot of buyers are going to walk away. Buyers are really sensitive to the price, so I probably want to keep my prices low for this particular product. If I say the demand for my product is less elastic or is highly inelastic, that means that buyers are not very price sensitive, and I can probably charge a higher price to many buyers or groups of buyers without them walking away. They like it so much that they're willing to pay even a higher price for this good. So in me deciding what prices I want to try to charge, in the process of discovering what prices will work for different consumers or different groups of consumers, it's useful for me to have some beliefs or some estimates or some idea of how price sensitive people are. So I might try to, you know, discover the relevant elasticity of demand for consumers in different categories. And economists famously say that, you know, retirees tend to have fairly elastic demands for different products because, you know, we old folks are not only because we're grouchy and you know, and crotchety old men, but it's because we have the time, because we're not working full time, to shop around. And people who are willing to shop around are going to be more sensitive to price than people who are not willing to shop around.
Yeah, so it keeps driving us back to the idea that pricing is it's individual transactions, it's different levels for different people in different circumstances at different moments. And that's the art of pricing, is to be able to find that flexibility and act on that flexibility. I want to cover one other thing, Peter, while we've got time, and it may be we spend another podcast on it. But the other act in which Austrian economics can really help entrepreneurs, I think, is the reverse of pricing. I've discovered the pricing. Now I assemble my resources to a level of costs that gives me a profit. So the consumer setting the price, I discover that. Now I manage my costs, which is the opposite of the way that many people naturally think. And they may teach it in business school, which is cost plus pricing. You figure out your cost, you take a 40% margin, that's the price. So Austrians say the opposite. Let's cover that quickly, at least.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think this is another case where we have to distinguish between kind of the subjective experience of the entrepreneur while engaged in this process versus our kind of more objective analysis of what is actually going on, right? Because many of us, many entrepreneurs, you know, they feel like, look, I can choose whatever sticker price I want. And if I'm purchasing inputs from a large supplier, I just kind of have to take whatever price they demand, right? Well, again, that may be true from the point of view of who kind of sets the sticker price. But as we said before, you know, I as a seller, I can't just force consumers to pay whatever I want. You know, my cost plus my you know, what I paid plus 40%. Yeah, I'm free to write that on my sign. But what if nobody walks into the store? Right, then it's not the case that I got that price for my product. I wanted that price for my product. I didn't get it. And what I actually get may be a lot lower than that markup, right? So the cost plus pricing as a sort of a strategy for what business people should do, I don't think that's a very effective teaching tool. And I don't teach that in my business school classes because that, you know, That makes it sound like you can just get whatever price you want. I mean, gosh, if I could get cost plus 40%, why stop at 40? right? Why not go for 50, 60, 70, 80? Why not mark up by 500%? Right? Obviously, you can't do that. There's an upper limit. Well, that upper limit may be well below 40. But what I mean is, then if I'm buying from a large supplier, if I'm getting my materials from Office Depot, it feels like they're forcing me to pay whatever price they demand. But again, they're constrained by the demand of the buyers, just like I'm constrained by the demand of my buyers. And if entrepreneurs are not willing to pay those prices for inputs, then the sellers of those inputs are not going to be able to get those prices either. So in reality, there's a complex, multi-sided process going on, right, where prices, both the retail prices that the entrepreneur is asking consumers to pay and the wholesale prices that the wholesaler is asking the entrepreneur to pay, all of these are in a free market, right? Prices that are set through a kind of, through some kind of negotiation or bargaining or discovery process, you know, even though it may be manifest in a slightly different form in every case. So look, if I'm an entrepreneur, if I can put pressure on the people, my wholesalers, I'm certainly going to, right? I'm going to say, no, I don't want to pay that. I want to pay a lower price. Maybe I can get one. Maybe I can't. But here's the difference. The way Austrians understand costs, right? Costs are just prices. Costs are the prices that the seller pays to the upstream, you know, wholesaler. Right. Well, we call them costs from an accounting point of view, but they're not just sort of fixed or given to me by some exogenous force. They're the result of some kind of a bargaining procedure on the market for inputs. There's a market for inputs, just like there's a market for outputs. And the you know, the process that determines the equilibrium prices of those outputs, that same process works for determining the prices that are actually paid for the inputs. It just doesn't always appear that way on the surface if we're a small buyer, you know, buying from a large seller.
Right. So that's a fascinating way to look at it, actually. So the consumer determines prices, we've said, and then the entrepreneur who's in the center of the supply chain is going to determine the prices to the extent that he or she can, upstream from themselves by the same process. And
yeah, exactly right. And there's a famous, you know, the Austrian School of Economics, one of its famous historic contributions is clarifying the relationship between prices in terms of consumer valuations and the sort of costs that are paid on the market, right? The classical economists like Adam Smith and David Ricardo, despite their many wonderful insights into the market system, they had a mistaken view of the relationship between costs and price. They thought that the costs that firms have to pay are what determine the prices that obtain in the market for consumer goods and services, again, because they had a kind of a cost-plus mentality. Adam Smith famously, at least in some of his writings, embraced a kind of a labor theory of value, right? Why is why is an iPhone valuable on the market? Why is it able to command a price of $600 or $800 or $1,000, depending on what model? Well, it must be because it has a lot of really valuable stuff in it, right? It has rare minerals that are inside it and a lot of high-tech equipment, and it takes a lot of skilled labor to put it together, and none of those things are cheap. Therefore, those high input values are passed along to the consumer. That's what determines the high price of the iPhone. The Austrian economists said, no, that's got it backwards, right? So, you know, back in the days of BlackBerries, which was not that long ago, right? I mean, a BlackBerry is also expensive to produce, right? Mm-hmm. Just as expensive maybe as an iPhone, but a BlackBerry in 2019 does not command a very high price on the market. There are some of them that are still being manufactured, right? But they don't command a very high price, even though they also have skilled labor and rare minerals and so forth that go in them. Why? Because the consumers don't like that kind of device. Consumers have chosen iOS devices and Android devices, and they have walked away from other kinds of handheld electronic gadgets that are also expensive to produce. So the Austrians said, look, really the causal chain is the other way around. It's because consumers really value having a smartphone in their pocket, because consumers are willing to pay a high price for that device. Therefore, those values are kind of imputed backward to the values of the rare minerals and the skilled labor and so forth that goes into producing them. Karl Menger, the founder of the Austrian school, had a great example of this using a 19th century illustration. That was the tobacco industry. Menger said, "Is it true that cigars and cigarettes and pipe tobacco are expensive? They have high prices because the land on which tobacco leaves are grown is very productive and therefore costly land." Menger says, no. Menger says, imagine a world in which all of a sudden people decide they don't want to smoke. In fact, someone like Karl Menger would probably shocked. He would be shocked by the 2019 world in terms of how little smoking there is, right? But suppose that, you know, for health reasons or whatever, all of us decide, you know, we just don't like tobacco anymore. What's going to happen to the price of tobacco leaves? Well, if nobody's willing to buy cigarettes or e-cigarettes or cigars or pipe tobacco, that's going to, you know, the wholesale price of tobacco leaves is going to plummet, right? Well, I mean, who's going to want to pay money for a tobacco leaf? You can't make it into anything that somebody will be willing to buy. Yeah. So the price of tobacco leaves is going to fall. What's going to happen to the labor, specialized tobacco workers? The value of their labor is going to fall. Their wages and salaries are going to go down. What's going to happen to farmland that can only be used to grow tobacco and nothing else? Well, its price is going to fall, maybe even to zero, if it can't be used for anything else and nobody wants to smoke tobacco. So Menger said it's the value of the consumer good that determines the prices that will be paid for the factors of production that go into making it, not that the value of the factors is pushed forward somehow onto the prices of the consumer goods. Yeah. So that's the sense in which consumer valuation ultimately determines everything, the wages and salaries that you and I get, the values that land trades for in the land market, the prices of machines and capital goods. It's how valuable is the stuff those things can be used to produce. That's what determines the value on the market of those things.
Yeah, and there's another way in the modern age of digital innovation, Peter, that that Austrian idea of managing the costs or the prices in the supply chain is changing, and that's the management of channel costs. So I'm vaguely familiar with the wine industry, and I see developments there where perhaps the discovered price for a particular brand of good wine is $50. The consumer is willing to pay that price. To get that to a wholesaler and then to a retailer, the winemaker may have to pay $30 for those services, for warehouse distribution, retail distribution. Now, in this day and age, I can do it through direct to consumer, and I don't have to pay that $30. Now, I've got a little bit of UPS costs and that kind of thing, but it's not much. I've just tremendously lowered my costs and increased my profit with the same consumer price of $50 for the bottle of wine. So
absolutely. And of course, the challenge for me in that case is if other wine sellers discover that they can use the same channel reduction strategy that I used, they might start offering their wine to the consumer for $45, right? Mm-hmm. And so, right. You know, it's competition among entrepreneurs that keeps prices within sort of a reasonable range from the consumer's point of view. Again, it goes back to this idea of cost plus. The fact that I can try to charge a 40% markup doesn't mean that I can get it, not only because consumers may not like the product enough, but because other sellers who are willing to accept a lower markup just undercut me, right? So there's competition among entrepreneurs, just as there is competition among buyers for the services of those entrepreneurs. There's competition among wholesalers for the goods and services that they sell to entrepreneurs and so forth. So what we Austrians mean by a competitive market system is which throughout the whole value chain from beginning to end, anybody is free to give it a shot, to try to buy or to try to sell doesn't guarantee that they'll be successful, but they're free to enter or exit, to try their hand at any aspect of buying and selling. And we allow people to work out these things, you know, voluntarily. The prices that emerge from those voluntary, collaborative and competitive processes, you know, those are the prices that the entrepreneur uses for making decisions. And those are the prices that we economists are trying to explain.
Right. And they're historical, right, Peter? The only prices we know are historical prices. It's something that happened in the past. What happens in the future is to be determined.
Exactly. And so as an entrepreneur, and this goes back to conversations that we've had previously about how to understand the entrepreneur, you know, I know the prices that people paid in the past for goods and services like mine. I know the prices that maybe I or other entrepreneurs paid to our wholesalers in the past. What are the prices going to be tomorrow? Well, hey, that's up to me. I don't just take those as given by nature. It's not like what's the high temperature going to be tomorrow? I'm an active participant, either directly or indirectly, in the process of figuring out what the prices will be on both sides, on all sides of the transactions going forward.
So entrepreneurs shouldn't listen to any data or give any credence to any data that talks about price levels, price trends, anything that's an aggregate, right? Every transaction is one that they should be managing and analyzing and preparing for and weighing up the possibilities.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't put it quite that starkly. I would say that things like price levels or price indexes that analysts and government officials use to try to characterize, you know, inflation rates and so forth, I would take all of those with a grain of salt, right? I mean, there may be some useful information to come out of that. If somebody tells me, well, look, you know, the price level has quadrupled or quintupled or whatever in Venezuela over the last 6 months, I mean, yeah, that does tell me something about the kind of collapse of their economy and their monetary system and so forth. But as an entrepreneur, no, you don't want to use a price level forecast or a price level, even price level data of the past as kind of ironclad, you know, guides to behavior. First of all, because any index is just that. It's an average. It's noisy. There's some arbitrary choices that going into calculating the index and so forth. But also because, you know, as any investor knows, past performance is no guarantee of future results. So, you know, knowing the prices that a particular type of consumer on average typically paid for a good or service like this in the last year. Yeah, I mean, that's useful information. That is data that I as an entrepreneur can use in trying to exercise judgment about what will work in the future. But it's not like I can just blindly follow some simple formula, right? I've still got to use my intuition and my interpretation and, you know, my judgment to figure out what's going to work in the future.
Good. Well, thank you, Peter. We'll try and summarize this in one of our knowledge graphics, which we give away at Mises.org/E4E. And we covered a lot. We covered consumers setting prices. We talked about price discovery. We talked about how the entrepreneur can be active in setting their upstream prices through negotiation. And we talked about prices being relevant to individual transactions, but only one and only historically. So I hope we've been helpful to entrepreneurs.
As always, thank you for the great questions and for the very effective summary that you gave just now. But this is a great topic, and there's a lot of good literature on this topic, and be happy to help with some pointers for further reading that our listeners might enjoy.
Good. Is there anything that you can mention now, or is it something that we should post on our podcast page?
Yeah, I think there's some things that we can, it's maybe best to have some references, some links to articles that we can post on the website. There are rules of thumb and guides for how to engage in pricing. And there are also some good readings on how to understand or interpret the pricing environment around us that many of our readers will find helpful. So we'll get those links up on the site.
Good. Yeah, send them along and we'll post them at Mises.org. So once again, thank you very much, Peter. You've been very helpful as usual. We look forward to the next time.
Thank you, Hunter. I've really enjoyed it.
Economics for Entrepreneurs is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit Mises.org. That's Mises.org. For more from Hunter Hastings, check out HunterHastings.com.